Welcome to Driven Radio Show, your home for car talk covering the latest news to the greatest views on the biggest names in performance, sports, and just plain cool driving machines. Let's rev up the conversation. Time for Driven Radio Show.
Hey, all you gearheads and car fiends. Welcome to Driven Radio Show, your weekly automotive happy hour. I am Brett Hatfield here with my co-host and engineer extraordinaire, Mr. Mark Groves.
That's me.
And we are coming to you from Driven Radio Studios, where the temperature has plummeted about 30 degrees in the last 2 hours.
We have the most schizophrenic weather.
Welcome to Kansas.
Which personality do you want now?
Well, our weather makes Sybil look well-adjusted. It's just messed up. Tonight, I am recording my 300th show.
Dude, nice.
When we started the podcast 5.5 years ago, it was under the moniker Road Muscle Radio. And when we did that for 8 months or 9 months, and then you got buried.
Yeah, work ate me.
Absolutely munched your lunch. So Mark had to take a leave of absence, and when he did, I changed the name of the name to Driven Radio Show, and Vern came on, and he was my co-host for, I'd have to look. I forget how long, but eventually.
No, who's Vern? For the uninitiated?
Vern Estes used to be my co-host. He owns Vern and Estes Classics. He is my, he is a Shelby expert extraordinaire.
Yeah, Mustang Whisperer.
Shelby Whisperer, GT350s. He's a GT350, 1965 and 66 GT350 specialist, to the extent that I can call him up with one of the serial numbers from the first 2 years and he knows the car.
Good God.
Yeah. Yeah. He's
what a nerd.
Well, he's.
Jesus.
He's a savant like that. He just
is.
Yeah. And
nice guy.
God bless Vern and God love Vern. He's opened a lot of doors to a lot of people and a lot of things that I never would have been able to do, see, meet otherwise. Anyway, about the time Vern had to step away from the show, Mark was able to come back.
Yeah, and things evened out.
When he did, we went great guns with Driven Radio, but we also resurrected Road Muscle Radio and did a different type of show there. And of the Road Muscle Radio, the RMR iterations, we recorded 52 shows. This is show number 248 of Driven Radio. 248 and 52, that's number 300. Yay me.
Congratulations.
So there you go. It's the triple century, Mark.
And also many thanks to Corey, who jumped in as your co-host.
Yes, yes. We absolutely cannot forget Corey Pratt, who played a big part as our other co-host. And also, we've gotten to do a lot of cool stuff with Corey and got to do meetups and do other shows and got to go to the Great Car Show.
Yeah, he has Vanzilla.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Well, the urban assault vehicle. If you haven't seen the Craving Cars van, you need to check that out the very first chance you get. That could, you know, I think he could probably drive the sucker to the moon.
I wouldn't be surprised, and I wouldn't be surprised if he tried.
Anyway, Vern, Corey, Mark, thank all three of you for helping us get to this point. And yeah, 300 shows, baby. I can't even believe it myself.
It's pretty amazing.
A lot of cool stuff went on this week and this weekend. Mark, God bless you for coming over Sunday morning, helping my daughter Jaden with their voiceover for the animation project she's working on at school.
That was fun.
And for everybody who's listening and who doesn't know this, though Mark often says he doesn't know anything about cars, that's crap. He knows a lot more than he lets on. And he also calls himself our vehicular village idiot. Now, that's funny, but it's not accurate. And what everybody doesn't get to see, what all of our listeners don't get to see, but I do, is your true talent and brilliance. Mark has over 35 years experience in radio. He worked for Radio Disney, and at one time he managed advertising and promotions for more than 13 major markets all at once. And when I say he had to step away because his job ate him alive, that's why his job ate him alive.
It got busy.
And not only did he bring out the best in the script for the animation this weekend, but he also brought out the best in me, he made my performance so much better with just really subtle cues, but he really knows what he's doing. And I had long thought that I could be a voiceover talent or a voiceover artist. And I got a little insight this weekend into how much more involved and in depth it is and what it takes to be a really talented voiceover artist. And Mark is. I stand in awe of the man. He is a legitimate production genius. Everybody who listens to this doesn't get to see what I get to see. You should know that the guy is truly brilliant no matter what he says. So thank you for all your help and guidance this weekend. Really, really appreciate everything you helped me, Jaden, get done.
Absolutely. And, you know, being part of the show, I've learned so much more about Lamborghinis and Maseratis. And
not for me, though.
You know, I can walk up and down a Galaxy 500, but damn if I could do anything with class.
Yeah, well, what do you mean it's not a Corvette? Moving on. So anyway, people who listen to the show don't realize just how brilliant he is. And he is perpetually modest, and he's often the butt of his own jokes. But there is true talent sitting on the other side of this table from me, and I'm blessed to be able to work with him.
Oh, thanks. And thanks for keeping this going. It's a lot of fun.
And speaking of Mr. Groves, you are on the car hunt again.
Still, yeah. And yeah, we didn't touch on the trip up north.
No, hang on a second. I want to encourage everybody who listens to the podcast, get on social media, find him on Facebook, anywhere you can look him up, find him on Twitter under Mag Cow Media Mark, Mag, M-A-G, Cow, C-O-W. And for the love of God, encourage him to finally pull the trigger and buy that gorgeous 65 Mercury Monterey Breezeway he found on Facebook Marketplace. It's sexy. It's black over red. It's clean. It's kind of towards the northern end of your budget, I know, but it's a great look of car. It has no visible automotive leprosy in it. It's got a really clean interior, cool wheels, decent looking paint. It's got a big 390 under the hood, and you are overdue to pull the trigger.
Yeah, the more I look at it, the more I like it, because it looks like the type of car that was really what I need, is something that I can just go rolling in, go up to the car shows in without having to, you know, fix everything on it.
It's what the Green Hornet would have driven if he'd had more sense.
And a smaller budget.
Yeah. But that's a good looking car, man. And it doesn't have unsightly rust stains or anything really foul or weird.
Yeah.
And, you know, shy of coming with a couple of corpses in the trunk, you ought to just buy the damn thing.
Yeah, at least they fit, though. That thing.
Well, you could get more than two.
I drove a 65 Park Lane. No. It was a Monterey, because the Park Lane was the one we almost died in.
Yeah.
The 64 Park Lane.
I bet when you stomp on the brakes in this sucker, it doesn't steer you into oncoming traffic.
Into a diesel coming our way. But the lying preacher down in Arkansas, that was a 65. And actually, I've driven two. One was a two-door. But that was the one that we could fit a squirrel through the holes in the trunk.
That preacher in Arkansas, there's got to be a special place in hell for a preacher who lies to sell a car.
I'm sure somewhere along the line in the years since, he's gone in for tax evasion.
Oh, I think he should have to be Satan's plumber.
But those things are big, boxy, and they drive halfway decently.
Well, and the great thing about the Breezeway cars is
that roll down rear window, baby.
That back window rolls down. You roll down the side windows, you roll down the back window, you got a hard top convertible, baby.
And you still have wing vents.
Yeah.
So you're going to be shoving air. You're going to blow dry.
It was perfect for all the heavy smokers in the 60s, man. You didn't even need an ashtray. Just flick it and let it go out the back window.
Design brought to you by Winston-Salem.
I drive a mile for a camel.
A pretty cool car, and the 390 is able to move that bulk fairly well as it shoves his brick through the air.
Plus, it may not be fast, but you stick your foot in it, it makes cool sounds.
Yeah, it's got a blah, 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 blah to it. And even if it didn't, that is probably the one thing I would invest in. I watched actually a YouTube video a few days ago about cherry bombs.
Oh, yeah.
And
how
they were made, etc. And I'm like, oh, hell yes. Daddy needs cherry bombs. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, the wheels that are on that Merc are fine as is. But you know what I got to have.
No, but those wheels are good enough looking that yes. until you can stuff Kragers underneath the thing, it doesn't look bad.
Yeah, yeah, they did nice. Whoever picked them did
pretty decent. They're darker torque thrusts, and they're good-looking wheels. And I think you really ought to seriously consider that car.
Well, it's definitely a step up also. The weirdest thing, you know how I whined and bitched and moaned about, oh, I want a 55 Plymouth, blah, like my first car, 55 Plymouth, burger, burger, burger. And I went and I looked at one, this was 2 weeks ago, in Clarinda, Iowa. And by the way, hello, Clarinda, Iowa. That's a cool looking little town with a lot of really cool old houses in it.
Great. You should write a horror story about the whole stinking town.
You're not wrong, because the guy that I went to talk to about the car, he bought a house three blocks due west of his current house, which is huge and very old. And, you know, he was a chatty son of a gun, which is how I learned all of this. But apparently some old dude hoarder died in that house. Ugh. And his widow is in jail for his death. So when they bought the house, there was some carpet and some flooring that needed to be replaced.
That's a writing prompt.
Oh yeah, he took me through for a tour of the house, because they got a bunch of stuff from, you know, I can't remember the name of the place where you give all the leftovers. Oh hell yeah! Well, he invited me, and I'm like, sure, let's go. Yeah,
no, that's okay. I don't want to wind up part of the hoarding. How do you know they're not hoarding corpses?
They replaced all the carpet, and you know, it looked nice in there for what they've done. They not a lot of work. But point of the story, looked at a 55 Plymouth that was a 55 Plymouth Savoy, four-door. It wasn't eat up with rust at all.
Did it just not tickle you?
It had the two-speed torque flight.
Okay.
Which is torque flight, torque crawl. That is a gutless, gutless transmission. And and to add to the glory of it, it ran nice. Started up, cold start. Just boom, started right up. A flathead six in it. So it's like a 231 flathead six trying to move a small, you know, warship. Like
maybe 100 horsepower.
Oh, and I had forgotten. Guy was, you know, kind of funny. The one I was talking to, Rick, I believe was his name. He talked about how the steering was the Armstrong power steering. Yeah, I'd forgotten what it's like to really have to
make you a believer in arm day at the gym.
Oh my God. I'm like, I was young once and this didn't seem like such hell. So I drove it around town for a bit.
It's okay once you're moving.
And it was a fully disappointing ride. It was an old car in decent shape. And
I'm
that was
sorry
it. And,
to hear that.
And that love affair ended. I don't need, I'm not actually very interested in a 1955 Plymouth anymore.
Rhonda and I had a conversation about this, because I keep looking at old Camaro Berlinettos with the digital dash, the Starship dash, what they call it and everything. And I keep having fond memories of one that I owned when I was in high school. And I got in so much trouble in that car. And it had a gutless six, and I still managed. Every cop in Olathe knew me by first name.
Yeah.
And I keep looking at them, and there's not very many of them. It turns out they're rare.
Yeah.
In 1984, Chevy made 250,000 Camaro Z28s. They made 10,000 Berlinettas.
Oh.
They're legit rare.
Yeah.
And you can't find them very often. And if you do, they're usually hammered beyond belief. So finding one in good condition is that much more difficult. And I keep looking at them, and she keeps telling me, don't go back.
Yeah.
You got a laundry list of cars you want to own before you're done. I haven't had a 911 yet. Still want one. And she just says, don't go back. Don't go back. Remember it fondly for what it was.
Yeah.
And what it was a million tickets and, you know, having to go to state sponsored driving school. That's not a joke.
I know. That's what makes it
and
funny.
And you should have seen the burnouts after that. Everybody who left lit them up. But anyway, maybe it's just that you had that experience. You had that first car, and it's time for you to try out something else.
I think so. If I really dug down deep in my soul, I think The reason I love the 55 Plymouth so much, I can attribute to a gal named Cindy Perkins.
Okay.
And that's all you need to know about that story. Cindy, darling, you were such a friendly person when I was 17.
Yeah, well, you can never go back.
Healthy girl. Healthy Midwest girl.
Can you imagine us at our age and shape trying to do anything extracurricular inside a car now?
That's why I would have to have something like that Plymouth, because all it was two couches
you'd with have a to small have something ship. Like Corey's van. Oh. Something where you could stand up, move around. Here, I'm going to stand over here and take my clothes off. You stand over there.
Yeah.
There's a reason. You know, once you own a house, you don't go screw around in cars anymore. That's it.
Yeah, welcome to growing up.
All righty. Now for the good, the bad, and the ugly. If you've been watching Facebook, you've seen the pictures. The Schadenfreude Express lives. And for those of you who are not familiar, the Schadenfreude Express is a 1999 Mercedes-Benz S600 that I love to hate and I just love. It's been in our family for over 20 years. It's been owned by our family company, so everybody's kind of had access to it. And I drove it for a couple, or Rhonda drove it for a couple of years, and we used it as ours. And mostly my parents have used it. And it's one of those cars that really requires you be involved with it. It has to have regular or frequent and deep maintenance. It has to have a lot of stuff. As I'm the family gearhead, the car care was often left to me. But the car spent some years in San Diego at my folks' place there. I didn't have access to the car, didn't quite receive the frequent and involved maintenance that it needed. The S600 is a 6-liter V12.
Jesus.
Four valves per cylinder, so there's 48 valves in the sucker.
Yeah.
It has active suspension, double glazed side glass, automatic climate control, power stinking everything, including, remember, 1999, 25 years ago, back seats both reclined and were heated.
Good God.
Pretty big deal then. Not too many cars do that now.
No, not the back seat.
Not the back seat. It power everything, and it's one of the most complicated cars I've ever encountered. It's also considered one of the best engineered vehicles Mercedes ever made. They built it to a point, not a price.
Yeah.
The W140 platform debuted in 1991 as a 92, and the development for that platform cost Mercedes north of $1 billion. And those were in 1980s dollars. So anyway, after the health scare with my mom a few weeks ago, my dad decided he wanted to divest himself of all the stuff he didn't need to worry about so he could focus on my mom.
Yeah.
And very admirable of him.
Absolutely.
And as part of that, he gave me the Schadenfreude Express.
What a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, well.
Thanks.
You want to give your OCD something to do? Here you go. I put in a new battery, put in some seafoam fuel treatment, fresh premium gas, and son of a gun, it started right up.
No.
It had been sitting still for 3 years. Been sitting in a warehouse, and it just had 3 years worth of dust, and I'm not going to run, and I smell a little like critters and all that garbage. It started right up. Wow, it started right up. The tires are not in the best shape. They're a little... I kept checking them to see if they said Lego and not Goodyear. It has some cosmetic issues. It's got some nicks and chips, and both of the battery bumper covers need to be fixed. It is in dire need of a new set of tires. I ordered them today.
Did you?
Yeah.
You went and get them?
They'll be here Monday. New set of Michelins for it. It needs an ABS and ESP module. And if you know anything about these cars, that's ABS and traction control. 6-liter V12 without traction control, running 60 series tires on it. You stick your foot in it a little, it lights things up.
Oh my God. You could do a burnout in your Mercedes.
You can do a burnout at will.
We've got to film that before you get EBQS.
Whatever. In addition to that, it needs airbag propellants because they're over 20 years old. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. That might be nice. Needs a new or repaired pump for the door locks and the soft closed trunk. I didn't realize that they ran off a pump until I went to lock the doors and they said, no.
Yeah, not
doing it. It needs some work on the climate control because not only it will decide what vent you're going to get, you don't.
Oh, that's exciting.
It will just change at random.
You will take it and you will like it.
There are weird valves that direct the doors for where the climate control goes, and those valves don't work quite the way they should.
Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. You do not know where I'm going to blow.
No, you do not know.
You do not know.
You do not know.
American.
It needs a new driver's side seatbelt retractor. That seatbelt is about a foot too long right now, and that's how it stays.
That's exciting.
But with all of that said, some of the stuff is kind of tough to find, and I'm sure it's, you know, this is going to be the new project. But when everything is right on that car,
yeah,
when everything is right, it is one of the finest road cars made. The thing has absolute wings. It is bank vault solid. It is quiet inside.
Yeah,
you stick your foot in it, that V12 comes alive. It will absolutely haul ass. It is just fantastic. Now, I lack the mechanical background or skill of Tavarish or Sam Crack or any of the YouTube guys and most of the students that coming out of the restoration program at McPherson. So I expect that I will screw up as much as I manage to fix. I have had few other love-hate relationships like I have had with this car.
Yeah.
This is the first of the Schadenfreude Chronicles. Please stay tuned.
And so it begins.
And even with all of that said and with all of the needs, and the car is needy.
Yeah.
You know, this is not one of the things that responds well to deferred maintenance. Here's the weird thing. Those the 96 to 99 W140 platform, particularly the S600, have turned the corner and gone up in value.
Oh,
and really, really nice copies go for mid-30s to mid-40s now. And not that long ago, the car was worth about $6,000. So It's gone up in value quite a bit. Mine probably will never be worth that. I don't care. I'm gonna make everything right on it. And what's kind of funny is between the little red Mercedes convertible, the little SL500 we have, and the S600, I own two 99 Mercedes, and both of them are kind of the flagships for that model. They're some of the best that Mercedes ever engineered.
You know, it is interesting, your garage, between you've got hardcore Corvettes with your flag waving American cars, and then you've got, what, three German products?
Yeah. The Porsche and the two Mercedes. And then while you're at it, let's throw some Harleys in the mix.
Hell yeah.
And it's an interesting garage. And it's going to be interesting to see what I'm able to do with this car. I'm going to try to do as much of the work as I can myself. I'm sure I will need help along the way. But the Schadenfreude Express is mine, man. And for all the griping I've ever done about that car and everything it still needs, it's still an unbelievable car.
You know, when I got to sit in it there for a few minutes last time, Sunday, when we recorded with your daughter.
There's
your
17 cows worth of leather in that thing.
That thing, it's the only car I've sat in that looked at me and went, no, your ass is not too big. You have a fine buttocks. And it just cupped and it felt great. It was so comfortable.
Then that top half of the seat that slides electrically.
Oh yeah, it's ridiculous.
Longer,
that's awesome.
And you can recline the seat all the way. The car's made, you can sleep in it.
Yeah.
You can sleep in it.
Well, at the original price, you'd have to.
Well, yeah. I was telling Mark the other day, that car when it was new was $145,000.
Jesus Christ.
In 1999. And in 1999, I had a friend of mine in Overland Park buy a 4-bedroom, 2.5 bath, 2,500 square foot house with a 3-car garage, and he gave $145 for it. The car was a house.
Yeah,
it cost what a house did, and a decent little house at that.
Yeah, nice one.
Anyway, it's, you know, mine isn't worth what the really nice ones are, but I'll doll it up and I'll try to do the best I can with it. But man, there is no better long distance travel car. Remember the old joke, if you absolutely positively have to be there overnight.
Yeah.
This car can do that.
Yeah, it can.
Yeah, it can. So welcome back to the Schadenfreude Express. This is Woo-hoo! The first of the Schadenfreude Chronicles. I will keep you posted. Stay tuned. Our special guest this week is Lauren Goodman, supervising producer of media and exhibitions at Revs Institute in Naples, Florida. After earning her Master of Fine Arts in screenwriting from Florida State University's College of Motion Picture Arts, Lauren spent the next 6 years in Hollywood, where she worked in creative development for film and television properties and in production services for cable and new media advertisers. With her background in media and her keen interest in motorsports history, Lauren is perfectly suited to producing videos, new media projects, and curating new acquisitions and loans for Revs Institute. Lauren, welcome to Driven Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. It's we were supposed to have you a few weeks ago, and then Mark got sick, and then I got sick, yeah. and then Mark got sick, yeah. and we just had a tough time getting our schedules worked out.
You had the plague, it sounds like.
Oh, we had that garbage that's going around. Everybody I know has had either pneumonia or bronchitis this year. Just been horrible.
Yeah, but for a while we sounded pretty sexy.
So how did you become interested in motorsports history?
I'm a living, breathing testament to the power of media. Oh. I had come back to, I grew up here in Naples, Florida, where the museum is located, and I hadn't heard of it. And I'd been out in LA and the pandemic happened. Oh. So I found myself back here living with family and not a whole lot of people hiring in production, film production down here in Florida. So in looking for something to do, I turned to film and TV, which are things I love. And through things like Ford versus Ferrari, through Drive to Survive, through the Senna documentary they did on, I think, on ITV a few years ago. Through that, it opened up a world for me that I found I could sink my teeth into. And it could just be this rabbit hole that just consumed me and helped me get me through the pandemic.
So how did you find Revs Institute and how did you start working for them?
This happened, so right as the world was opening back up again, I was living with my sister who said, oh, for your birthday, let's go to a car museum because you love watching Formula One so much. And I saw on TripAdvisor, this local museum was recommended for F1 fans. And I said, a local car museum, come on, what's it going to be? Like a couple of like Thunderbirds and maybe a Model T, like whatever. I didn't even like look up the place before we went. I was just looking forward to having tacos for like my birthday brunch or something. And by the time, and so we booked the docent tour, and the docents there, they train for years to be able to do this. And it's a intense 2-hour tour that touches on the highlights of the entire collection. Anyway, I'm on this tour and we get up to the open wheel gallery. And by the time we're up there, I think I'm going to need a paper bag. I'm like hyperventilating. I'm like, I'm sorry, what? Is there, say that again. Is there a second Stirling Moss? I don't understand. Like Dan Gurney, like you're singing to Dan Gurney, like it's the Dan Gurney. Like, mm-hmm. What are you talking about? You're talking nonsense. Almost angry about it. Like, what are you talking about? And of course, the museum had been right there the whole time. And I'm actually in the case of a lot of people from the area say, I didn't know this was here. And a lot of that has to do with the museum's history. It started really as a private collection that then became a private museum. And now in its life cycle, it's gone to a public museum. And now it's trying to be a more internationally known public museum.
Isn't it wonderful when you find an absolute gem like that right in your own backyard?
It's terrific. And fortuitous first tour, my tour guide, who's now my very good friend, a guy named Rock Linkoff, said he could see it was really interested. And he asked me, you know, what I liked about cars. And he said, well, you know, we're always looking for volunteers here. And I said, I'm pretty new. I don't know a ton about cars. He says, we teach all that stuff. Don't worry about that. We could teach you about the cars. And they do. That volunteer program, it's a whole thing. You have a mentor, there's a workbook, you get training on every single car in the collection. And the idea being, if people bring their enthusiasm, you can give them the knowledge. Because the most important thing about cars is people.
Now I'm
so if you're somebody who wants to connect to people about cars, everything else, you know, you can gain the content knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now I'm feeling like I need to go to Naples.
Anytime, my friend, anytime. And I got to tell you, one of my favorite parts is I'll close the circle on the story. I started volunteering there on the weekends and I was doing my regular day job, which was, you know, just something to get through the pandemic. And after that, for a couple of years, I said, OK, time for me to move on. And it just so happened I was looking for jobs. I thought maybe in marketing, maybe in for a team or something like that, just because I thought, well, that's where my skill set kind of is. I guess that fits. And our curator of collections, Scott George, who you already know, we were talking at one of the volunteer events one day, and he hadn't known about my background at LA. And he said, oh, would you like to do a little freelance marketing writing for us? And I said, sure. And that kind of took off. And then pretty quickly it became a full-time gig, mostly because it's not just the video production I love. It's also the curatorial stuff. I'm a real nerd about research and putting my nose in a book. I like that kind of thing.
Oh, I can relate.
So you kind of fell into this perfect condition, this perfect place for you.
It was something one of my other friends at the museum said about, he'd been talking about his wife, who also had a very varied career background, a lot of different types of jobs. But he said it's almost like every weird job she had helped her and prepared her for the next thing.
Nice.
And I really do feel that way, because I've had, you know, my educational background was really varied. Even my work background in Hollywood was not straightforward. And I want to be clear to anyone listening at home, I was a nobody. Don't think for a second I was some A-list producer. I was one of the tens of thousands of people just making their way, making a living every day, putting their hand in this, putting their hand in that. But every single one of those experiences, I think, has helped me for being able to tackle now this really exciting new opportunity, so I'm thankful for that.
Pretty cool background, though.
Yeah, to do films, or are you saying you were waiting tables?
I was. I'll tell you what I did. I went out there. And I was, as most people, I just interned a lot, which I just worked for free at a few different companies. And I decided after interning in feature film production, I'd gone out there to be a writer, and I knew feature films were no longer the way to go for writers. And I was looking at getting into television, and just I needed a job. And at the time, I met a friend who said, oh, hey, my buddy needs somebody who can be an office PA, my buddy who makes TV commercials and cable promos, and just as production services. And he said, you've done that before, right? And I said, yeah, sure.
Who has?
I had absolutely not done that before.
Nice.
It was very much a story of like me showing up to this gig and like pulling my car over to the house and like being like, getting, you know, like praying, like, dear God, I know we don't talk a lot, but I have not enough rent money in my bank account. Please let this guy like me and let me do a good job today.
So,
and I did. It worked out. And that guy ended up being my boss for about 3 years and taught me almost everything I know about producing.
At some point, did he figure out that you didn't have any kind of background doing this?
Yeah, but not until after a few sessions. Because really, you wait until you give the impression you know what you're doing, and then you can gently let on, oh, by the way, I had no idea. But here's the thing, is most people in LA don't know what they're doing. So they're probably in the same boat.
You nod and frown at the same time. Oh,
yeah, that's very interesting.
Oh, they must know what they're doing.
No, nobody in cars is like that, right? No, nobody. No.
Are you kidding me? It
sounds like your blinker fluid's down.
Yeah, the first assignment I ever had for a sports car market, they had sent out an email asking if anybody wanted to be an auction analyst. And I said, sure, yeah, I'll be one. Can you send us a writing sample? Yeah, I can do that. I've always been able to write. That's fine. Okay. Do you own a camera? I know where they sell them. I can go get one. And they said, All right. Well, take your camera and your pen and go to Dallas.
Yeah. Shazam.
And that you're was a journalist. That was what they told me. Go to Dallas. Everything else from there was just figuring it out. And that's been about 8.5 years ago. And I'm a senior auction analyst for them now. So I figured it out.
But you'll figure it out or you won't. They're kind of the two options
I'll figure it out or I'll die trying. I know exactly where you're coming from. So for you, what sets Revs Institute apart from other auto museums? There are some fantastic auto museums out there, but Revs Institute is truly unique.
I think what's really special about Revs Institute, and I've, again, some incredible museums out there, each doing something special and important. What I love particularly about the collection on display is over, for those at home who've never been, it's really terrific. It's the Institute is not only a museum, but we've got a huge library and archive, which is a huge part of what we do. It's often kind of behind the scenes, and a huge workshop. Because of the over 100 historically significant cars that are on display, they're all kept in working order.
Wow.
And with the exception of a few that are extremely fragile, because we're talking about finishes that are original to like 1896 in some cases, everything gets exercised. So the cars which are street legal, we'll take them out. We'll take them around the block. We'll see definitely people posting around town. Oh, I saw one of the Revs cars today, because, you know, it's not every day you see a 917K like rolling down the road.
No.
You know, and there are a few. Of course, it's also a very motorsport focused museum. Not entirely. It's not all motorsport, but it's predominantly motorsport. And we have to take those things to the track, because where else are you going to be able to get the temperatures up and cycle the engine the way you need to? Because that's what those cars were meant to do. And so to keep them in working order, you have to at least hit, you know, what is it, like 80% of whatever, you know, the total revs you could hit on something before you redline, that kind of thing, right, to get all the everything warmed up and get it running. And what's fabulous about that is not only does it keep the cars, the term we use is active matter. That's probably something Scott even mentioned when he was on.
Yeah, he did.
So this idea of these things, to really understand them, you got to see them run. You got to understand how they operate. And I think for fans, when we're able to bring the cars and exercise them at events to be special for fans who are a little more seasoned, but also to inspire young people to be interested in these historic automobiles, because it's going to be them taking care of these vehicles in the future.
I understand one of your early projects for Revs Institute was that of Lucy O'Reilly Shell. Who was she, and why was she significant?
I think there are some projects you get shoved into not realizing that it's going to change your life. So this was back when I was volunteering just on the weekends. Chip Halverson, who's presently the president of our volunteer board, and our volunteers are really interesting because they're self-governing. It's not of the volunteer coordinator telling them what to do. They have their own board of directors. They have their own committees. And the idea being it's because so many of them have such great backgrounds in cars and museums and things like that. They have so much to offer. They don't need somebody at the top, telling them what to do. Like, they're very active and they're always willing to participate. So anyway, one of the things they do is a volunteer will take on a little research topic, and usually about a car, one of the cars in our collection, and do a special presentation about it as a continuing education at a monthly meeting the volunteers have. And it's fun. It's like a PowerPoint. You do a kind of show and tell almost, and it helps keep everybody sharp, and it helps us do continuing education and refreshing about the collection. And I was asked by Chip if I would cover Lucy O'Reilly Shell, who the book Faster by Neil Bascom had come out not that long before. She features heavily. And of course, she's also very important in our collection, because upstairs in our open wheel gallery, we have a Maserati 8-cylinder that was sent by her team to the Indianapolis 500 in 1940 as a Franco-American car to, you know, put the French cause front and center, because of course, 1940, America had not entered the war yet. And it was actually at Memorial Day weekend that Paris fell to the Nazis while these cars were running.
Oh, wow.
And best of all, one of the drivers she sent two drivers and a reserve driver who was also a mechanic. One of the drivers was Rene Dreyfus, who we'll get to in a second. And the reserve driver mechanic was Luigi Canetti Sr., who, of course, went on to found North American Race Team and be the Ferrari importer here in America. So that's actually how he got to America, was on the boat with this Maserati coming over to run in the Indianapolis 500. But Lucy is really an incredible person because, as far as we know, she's the first woman ever to be a team principal of a Grand Prix team. And she decided that she, American citizen, grew up in France and loved racing cars. She herself did hill climbs and she did the Monte many times, placing as high as P2 overall, I think in 36 or 35. And she decided her driving career, she's going to hang up her driving gloves, but she wanted to be a team owner. And first she started fielding sports car teams. But one of the things that's covered beautifully by Neil Bascom in his book is the French government realized that they were really stinking at Grand Prix racing. open wheel stuff they were not doing so hot at, which was really a big point of French pride. So the French government and the governing body, motorsport governing body, offered a million-franc prize to, you know, the French company that could build the fastest Grand Prix car to the new standards coming to Grand Prix racing, which, for those at home who don't know, by Grand Prix racing, I mean the open wheel racing that's the forerunner to Formula One.
Yes.
And was organized as Formula One after 1950. So we're talking about like early Formula One cars, essentially. And Lucy's like, yeah, I could probably do that. And she went to her friends at Delahaye and said, Delahaye, build me a Grand Prix car. And they're like, okay, if you have the money, let's do it. And they won the competition, they won the prize. And then she went on to enter that car in the 38 season, and they beat the Nazis at the season opener at Po in France.
Oh, God bless
her.
The
best part is the driver, if you remember, I mentioned our friend Rene Dreyfus, who was at the Indy 500. Rene Dreyfus was the driver who did that, and Rene Dreyfus was Jewish. He was a great driver, but that's the reason he couldn't get a job with the Germans, was because he was Jewish. The Italians said, we don't want to hire him either because we want an Italian guy. We're fascists now. We want an Italian guy in our fascist Italian cars. So
brilliant.
And so she was a character. So I did just a kind of I meant to just do a bit of research on her to do a project. Anyway, you know, 2 months later, as I'm like, I look like I'm one of those crazy people who's living in a bunker at this point, because my room is covered with all of the notes I've taken. And I built her family tree on ancestry.com to like get more info on her. And like, anyway, I'm not insane, I promise, but I had so much fun doing the presentation. And then I went on and did a much shortened version of the presentation at the Society of Automotive Historians puts on a conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to go to do that presentation and just meet a lot of other car history nerds. And I just felt very at home there and really enjoyed myself. So that's always kind of a good sign when you're having a good time with people and feel really at ease. Like, oh, maybe these are the kind of people I need to spend more time with.
Yes.
And where I should focus my career.
Absolutely. Can you discuss some of the museum's recent acquisitions?
Yes, I can. So I think most notably recently, we're always doing a lot in the terms of our archival acquisitions. So André Van Beever was a really big one. He was a Belgian motorsports photojournalist who worked during really the golden era of racing and was friends with just about every major Belgian racer you can think of, you know, Bianchi, Meurès, Eakes, like he knew them all. And he died a few years ago, and his widow kept everything together. So over 29,000 negatives. Which we've acquired, yeah. And it's of course, it will take quite a while to digitize, but we wanted to go ahead and tell the world, oh, hey, we got this, because it's great news. Yeah. It's great news. These things are going to be preserved and shared for the future, and we're going to put them online, because that's our ultimate goal, is all these images go online through Rev's Digital Library, which is right there on our website. and anyone can search it. And not only that, even though we add metadata, people can add their own metadata. So it's user generated. So, which is great, because sometimes, so I've been running our socials for a little bit, and I'll just, you know, I'll put up something like an old Volvo, and I'll put from a rally, and I'll just write a little bit like, oh, this is the rally it was in, and here's the driver, co-driver. And somebody within a minute has commented like what kind of car it is, where it finished, like what they had for breakfast that morning. Like, it's incredible, like, what people know off the top of their head. And I'll message them and be like, do you just want to do this on our website for fun? Because you should. You absolutely should. It becomes almost like a, I don't know. If you like ever navigate Expedia to the webpage, you'll see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you ever navigate to it, you'll see it. Every photo kind of has its own webpage. And on it, at the bottom, it's like a text box. And people can add their tags to it, their notes about it, and that becomes part of the searchable material. So one of our favorite authors, Doug Nye, he's done tens of thousands of these, I think, and it's been invaluable. And Doug's like, he just likes to have his mug of tea in the evening and go through and say, I know who that is, and type that in, you know, and that becomes searchable forever.
Wow.
So anytime somebody goes and looks for that, you know, if he's written down, oh, that's Mike Parks over there at the side, it's going to come up when people search for Mike Parks.
Very cool.
Nicely done.
I love that when you go to open the digital library, the very first image there is a black and white of Jim Clark. That's that's extremely cool. I'm a huge Jim Clark fan. So that's just, it was neat to see that pop up as the first image. What is the Revs Institute Pony Pedigree Exhibit?
This was a loan, actually, in our galleries as part of the permanent collection. There's a Mark I and a Mark IIb GT40 right next to each other. And normally there's a Chevy Grand Sport sitting next to them, too. We lent the Grand Sport to the Peterson, and the Peterson said, well, what would you want kind of in return? So that way, you know, you have something filling your space. And we said, well, why don't you send us another GT40? So then we got three in a room. And the one they had was the Mark III, which was really unusual because the Mark III is the GT40 that was always designed to be only a road car and was like kind of a failure. Like, nobody bought it. Like, I think of the seven made, I think three of them were just retained by Ford for press use.
Yeah.
It was a classic case of, you actually had to go to John Wire to buy these things because John Wire still had the contracts to make GT40s for customers, both the Mark I for racing and the Mark III. And you could go to John Wire and he could say, well, yeah, you can get the Mark III for, I think, 18 and 5 or something like that. And it's slower and bigger. Or you could get a Mark I in full race tune, but with a few conveniences that make it road legal for less money. I think I'd take the Mark One, just between the three of us.
Like there's even a question.
So, you know, and the other things too that some people didn't love, for example, you know, the GT40 famously, you know, right-hand drive and has right-hand shifter for your gearbox, yeah, right between, you know, the driver and the door. So they changed that to the middle. You know, they changed all the linkages so that way you could have a central gear shift. So that way you could have a left-hand or right-hand drive.
Yeah.
And in fact, the example we have from the Peterson is a left-hand drive because the original owner was based in Austria. But of course, then that additional linkages, some people said, oh, I can really feel the difference in the responsiveness of the transit. So, you know, a lot of people had lots of little complaints about it. They increased the length of the body by 8 inches to accommodate quote unquote luggage space, however you would define luggage space.
Uh-huh.
It's really like a little oven, really, because it's just a little metal box right over the engine. So I guess if you brought some biscuit dough with you, you'd have biscuits by the time you got there, I suppose. But it's still gorgeous. And it's kind of incredible to see this GT40, the shape without any livery on it is pretty cool. So we said, okay, we got these three GT40s in one room. How do we talk about it? How do we say more than just, oh, this is kind of neat to have three of a kind? So we wanted to make it a story about what is the lineage of if we have a 1, a 2B, and a 3, what's the family tree going on here? And what's interesting, I thought it was going to be a pretty easy story to tell. But once I got into it, I found out how confusing it is. But to me, that's always anytime something confuses me, that's when I want to know more. And that's when I want to sniff it out, because I say, wait a minute, if it's confusing to me, I bet it's confusing to a lot of other people too. And I think if we can tease out a through line here that makes sense to a lot of people, they might engage with it more. So instead of it being three cars that are kind of alike, maybe people could walk through and see, okay, I could see the progression here. And for me too, to tell a human story behind it, I think, and this is just my impression, but that a lot of the literature I found about GT40s really kind of favored Eric Broadley and Lola, and seemed to not focus as much on Carcraft and on Roy Lunn. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that seemed fair to me, just with what I was reading about things. So by that, I mean, not that there, Eric Broadley and Lola were important, but I felt like that story had been told and I heard a lot of people repeat it. So I wanted to talk more about Roy Lunn, who was central to Ford and one of the most important automotive designers of all time, but sometimes not a name that was heard a lot, but he was central into getting the first Mustang concept done. And the Ford Mustang concept being a mid-engine car, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the same principles are what Roy took with him, because he was in charge of setting up Ford Advanced Vehicles in the UK. In a sense, going over there and starting up Ford's shop over there. Once that got started with Eric Broadley, and then Eric Broadley didn't work out, so they put John Wire in charge. Roy Lunn coming back to the US and realizing, gosh, it's kind of nice if we can just keep developing things. Not exactly under Ford's aegis, because there's a lot of red tape when you're working for Ford Motor Company.
Yes.
So he went down the street to Carcraft and said, we're just going to buy you. And you're going to be essentially a Ford subsidiary, but it allows us just enough independence. We can do a little research and development without all the Ford red tape and without Iacocca, you know, breathing down our neck the whole time. And that's what he did. And so that's where the J car was developed. That became the Mark IV, which of course was one of the Le Mans winners. And so I wanted to talk about that pony pedigree of this. It was a descendant from this original Mustang One concept, and how it kind of through Roy Lunn and of course a lot of the people from Ford, a few people went over to Ford Advanced Vehicles in the UK and then came back and helped at Carcraft. So from the very beginning, there's a line you can trace through this Mustang One, which is different than what you eventually see in the production pony car, but by kind of building this family tree and a mural on the wall, so you could see, oh, I can kind of trace the through line here and see how it developed. And of course, the production Mustang had a very fine motorsport history of its own. So I kind of liked seeing that family tree all together.
You know, this job has turned you into a geek now. You're one of us.
I think, you know, when I realized that was when I was volunteering, we took a bus up to Orlando for the Meekum auctions, mm-hmm. a bunch of volunteers. And we were there all day and I made a ton of new friends. And when I got home,
that this year? Did you go to Kissimmee for that? Or was it the Orlando Summer Special?
That was, how many years was that ago? That was a few years ago. It was a few years ago. And I got home and I told my mom all about it. And she said, oh, well, where are the pictures of your new friends? And I looked through all of my camera, my phone, and I hadn't taken any photos of human beings.
No.
Like there were.
No, you don't do that.
Yep.
There were like 20 photos of like the same like Honda S2000.
Yeah.
And none of like the new friends I'd made.
No, no.
Or spent like 5 hours talking to on the bus.
Now, you wind up on Facebook trying to hunt down. Oh, that's right. That's what you look like.
Oh, yeah.
But because you've got 1,000 new pictures of all the cars in there, and there might be a person in the background. It was somebody you were trying to get to go away before you shot the picture. Yes, I understand that. I'm in touch with that. I understand you're a sometime podcast contributor. Could you tell us about the Break Fix podcast and your area of interest?
I can. This happened back when I was at the conference, when I was talking about Lucy O'Reilly Shell. I met Eric from Grand Touring Motorsports, who was there doing the AV and producing it. And we got to chatting, and he said, "Do you ever do any podcasting?" I said, "I don't think so, unless somebody's been recording me secretly and playing Truman Show style." But he said, "You know, if it's something if you really love history, we address, you know, some stuff about history, some stuff about women in motorsports. So you could, if you ever want to do a little co-hosting, let me know." I said, "Sure." And that's been really fun. So whenever our schedules align, and of course I have an open invitation. I don't just have to do women in motorsport, but it just so happens to be the thing I'm most interested in. So there's a new, like, it's not sanctioning body. That's not a term I'm thinking for. It's now part of the Motoring Podcast Network.
Oh, cool.
So there are a few different podcasts. Eric is either producing, or he's brought in people who are also interested in this, so people can find it all in one place. So there are podcasts devoted just, Break Fix has more of a trying to tell people's story, letting people tell the story of how they got to where they are. Whereas other people might talk more about history or more about a particular mark or more about the technology. So it's kind of a, you know, it's nice because then every podcast has its own perspective.
Yeah,
it's all personal. Bringing to the table.
Yep. Well, and speaking of telling your own personal story, what is the dumbest thing you've ever done in a car?
Well, what can I say that will allow me to keep my job?
Yeah, and everybody always claims statute of limitations and crap like that. No, don't. Just let it rip.
Can I tell you the dumbest thing I've ever done associated with a car? How about that?
Sure.
This is back when I was getting my MFA, they sent us to London for a semester to study playwriting and some other stuff. And so at the time I was driving this two liter turbo Passat. And I left it at my sister's apartment. And I said, "Okay, I'm going out of town for 4 months. So will you go downstairs and turn it on sometimes and let it run for a couple minutes?" She said, "Yeah," which of course meant no, that never happened, which normally wouldn't be a big deal. But I said, "You know what? I'm going to be responsible. I'm going out for 4 months. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to buy myself a little car cover," right? Because I had to park it outside in this apartment complex, and there are trees and things and pollen and sap. So I got this cover, and it was permeable, and I thought it was great. Here's the thing. The Volkswagens of the time were kind of notorious for having issues with their drains in the moonroof, right?
Oh, no.
So you probably know where this is going. Florida tends to rain quite a bit, and I had a permeable cover on, right? So water could get through. But also, it was dark in there. And so it was wet and dark and hot on the inside of my car for 4 months because my sister never went down to start it. So by the time I get home from the UK and I go to my car and unwrap it, the entire interior, I mean, every inch is covered in mold.
I was going to ask which variety of mushroom was growing in that car.
I said to myself, I opened the door. I said, I don't think I can get in this. I think I'll die. So I had to call State Farm and say, they're like, "What's wrong? Did you have an accident?" I said, "Sorta. I think maybe you should just come down here." The adjuster who came out, this was back in Tallahassee. He's a good old boy. And he said, "Been doing this 40 years. Ain't never seen nothing like this." Here's the thing. State Farm didn't even total it. They had it towed. They had it towed
kidding.
To an interior specialist. Mm-hmm. Wow. And they just bleached the heck out of this thing. Messed up all the wiring. So then I had to go to somewhere else to get rewired. I finally got it back. It smelled like bleach the rest of the time I had it. Ran fine. But the check engine light never went off. So we called it my Moldsmobile for the rest of the time I had it. I actually love that thing. I love that engine. But by the time I had to move to California after I graduated, and California won't let you register a car if you've got a check engine light on. And there was just, by that time to fix it was more than it was worth. So goodbye, Moldsmobile.
You should have let them total it for you.
Yeah.
You really should have encouraged them to total it for you. I can't drive that. I have allergies. I can't be in that car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something along those lines. We have been speaking with Lauren Goodman of the Revs of Revs Institute. Lauren, please tell us where we can find you and Revs Institute online and on social media.
Well, please do visit our website at any time, revsinstitute.org. And we're also on Instagram at Revs Institute. We have a Facebook page where we also post events. Just look for Revs Institute. And if you look for us on social media, it is if you look for us on YouTube, it's at the Revs Institute. There's a whole thing behind that, but you do have to put in the before the Revs Institute.
I'm sure there's there that nobody cares about. It's one of those where, damn it, somebody got my page.
Curse you.
It is. It's a whole story. It's a whole story.
I understand completely. I've run into the same thing myself a couple times. Lauren, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. It was so fun to talk to you guys.
Thank you so much for spending time with Driven Radio, especially on this, our 300th show.
Number 300.
Really cool, man. Woo-hoo! And thank you, Lauren Goodman, so much for being with us. We've been trying to get Lauren on for a while, and we just had other stuff get in the way, and we appreciate you being patient with us and coming on when we finally got to the point we could go through a show without coughing our lungs out.
I have to admit, you know, because I'm over here running the little board, I did kill the mics a few times so I could cough. But beyond that,
if you look to my right, can you see the stack of wrappers from the halls I've been eating through the show? Dude,
are you chewing them? Damn.
I'm trying not to let anybody know.
Good times.
Thank you so much for spending time with Driven Radio. We love what we do, and we wouldn't be able to do it without the support of our listeners. You can find us online at drivenradioshow.com. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Driven Radio Show, and on LinkedIn as the Driven Radio Show podcast. If you have a story you would like to tell or someone you would like us to interview, please contact me at brett@drivenradioshow.com. I've had a few people contact me, and for whatever reason, they've been trying to do it at info@drivenradioshow.com.
It must be out somewhere. It's probably like on some Twitter thing that you haven't looked at.
It must be, but that immediately gets kicked back because we don't have a mailbox at info.
Oh, crap.
We got a mailbox at Brett. So Brett@drivenradioshow.com. Also, once again, we mentioned this last week. I need to mention it again. If you're listening to the show, please do us the favor of downloading it. Podcast services don't track streaming.
Dirty bastards.
And Apple iTunes does not report their listens.
Double dirty bastards.
So if you're going to listen to this, please download it so we can get a more accurate count of who's listening to it. Because,
and so we can suck up to an advertiser soon.
Well, there's always that. But honestly, for as many people as I have tell me they listen to the show, and also, you know, we get reports from like LinkedIn. We post the show on LinkedIn every week, and I get reports saying you've had this many impressions for that post. Man, that number is a whole lot bigger than the download numbers we're seeing. So please, for the love of God, if you're listening to it, just do us the favor of downloading the show. We would be forever grateful.
Yeah, put it on a thumb drive, send it to your grandma. Yeah,
that'd be fantastic. Passing around the family, let everybody listen to it. I am Brett Hatfield for Mark L. Groves.
Yep.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time here on Driven Radio.
Ah, oh, thank God.
See?